This is the March 25th, 2015 statutory interpretation class. And as usual, those of you listening in have missed the first 5 minutes of class where I revealed the secrets of the universe and exactly what's on the final. Okay, so with the Sonra case, bottom line was Scalia's concurrence was basically, this is superfluous. We are reaching the same result we would have reached if we just looked at the text. Why invoke the genie of legislative history? And I gotta say, although I have to confess that I tend to beat up on Scalia a little bit in this class just because it's always fun, guy has a point here, doesn't he? Look at all the cases we've read so far this semester. Try and find how many of them where legislative history was invoked to reach a conclusion that might not have already been available anyway with just a straight up textual statutory framework analysis. And you'll find that probably a large majority, if not an overwhelming majority, the legislative history is lagniappe. It's add-on. And this is a continuing debate as to whether you need to invoke legislative history reflexively, just because you should, or whether or not you only invoke it when it actually might materially alter the outcome of the statutory text analysis. And remember, I said three opinions. The last one was the sort of surprising opinion from Justice Alito, who invoked for the first time the concept that you could go to legislative drafting manuals. And this is sort of a new area. I've given you now on the website access to the Texas legislative drafting manuals. But essentially the idea is that if you're going to try and figure out how legislators meant to use words, look to their own rule book as to how the words are meant to be applied. And it's not, notice, used authoritatively. It's used as a guidepost. It also arguably might raise some issues in terms of whether or not a manual written for one purpose can be applied in a specific way to a specific statute where the circumstances of drafting may be unique. The bottom line is, start thinking about this as another additional source of materials. So with that, those were our three cases. That was the review of conference committee reports, general committee reports as well as conference committee reports. And now we're starting to go, as always, deeper into the weeds. Next up is we're going to talk today about what do you do when you get past committees to individuals. What role does the individual sponsor or drafter of legislation play when you're doing statutory interpretive analysis? So remember I said I was planting a seed as to we had that general discussion on conference committee, but any committee report. And we had a general discussion beginning as to why they were good, why that might be a good approach, why it may be misleading kind of content. So let me just simply state the general concept. What would be good about actually asking the person who wrote the statute what they were thinking at the time when they wrote it? I think the advantage of it seems to be fairly straightforward. If your goal is to understand intent, that seems to be at least salient. What's the downside, though?
It's kind of the same criticism that's always done with legislative history. It's not really introduced before the legislative body itself, and so you're really only going off what the intent of one person is within the body versus like the entire, what everybody in the body might have been thinking.
Absolutely true, but isn't the implication that the intent of the author was what the rest of the body was signing off on?
I think that'd be hard to infer. I mean, simply because, like we talked about before, a lot of congressmen and senators are very partial of the time, so they only go with very brief summaries of what a staffer might tell them what it is. So they may not know exactly what the drafter himself actually did.
That argument cuts a lot of different ways, though, doesn't it? Hey, believe me, I'm a big believer in the concept of strategic ignorance. You guys are experiencing this right now, I'm assuming. You just don't have time to track down and learn all the information that you could conceivably. So you have to prioritize and decide what you're not going to know. There's actually some fascinating economics analysis of this concept. What we're talking about here is their legislative body. They can't possibly know every bill and every subject, so they basically choose not to know. I'm suggesting that perhaps that argument cuts a lot of different ways. How can you describe anything other than signing on to the sponsor's intent if someone chooses not to make the extra effort of actually learning it and going deeper, just says, I trust you. Anyway, I'm not picking on you. I saw a couple of other hands go up. And now they're strategically saying, quiet. Yes?
Well, he covers what I was going to say. It's just that, you know, what he was getting at doesn't represent the compromises that are getting probably or represent the compromises that are later made in the past discussion.
So intent is more than just the author's intent. Intent is a synthetic intent of the entire body as that language mutates throughout the entire legislative process.
So if you're going to talk about congressional intent as a whole, there is that debate.
So
otherwise, it seems like what the book referred to as just looking over a crowd.
Which is a great book, by the way. And I guarantee it'll pop up again when you write a brief at some point in your life. But what if the language doesn't change? The sponsor writes something and sails through Congress, other parts of the statute change. Does that mean we need to rethink what the author meant in that particular provision that survived and escaped?
I just think it's a lot stronger representation.
Why?
Because there's no evidence that people disagree, unless I mean, then again, I think the fact that they didn't know what his intent was is salient as well.
Okay.
His intent matches up with the report.
All right. No, and you've got a point there. I'm just sort of shaking you a little bit because it's always fun to do that first thing in the morning. Any other thoughts? There you go. That's a fabulous comment, and I wish we had a whole other hour to dive into it. The rest of everyone's like, God, no. But there seem to be two thoughts there. One is the sense of secret intent, strategic play, where one group who wants to achieve a goal says something different with the idea of manipulating the process to get that goal to other means. And we do see it. The idea of mischievous staffers and lobbyists inserting language into reports to try and backdoor in the concepts they want. We'll come back to that in a second. The other is, I think, perhaps another almost philosophical point, which is two people having a conversation or one person writing is, by definition, going to have a different kind of intent than a larger group making a collective decision, and you can't equate the two. That takes us to the exciting terrain of semiotics and linguistic theory, which it's, I think, another building across campus, but it's an interesting thought. All right, so we've got the possibility of lack of bicameral presentation. It's not just like any other legislative history challenge. This is something the same one. We've got the idea that there's some sense of disingenuity, falsity, strategic game playing. We've also got the possibility that one person's intent, by definition, cannot equate to a larger synthetic intent of the entire legislature. Notice these were all exactly the same brilliant comments you guys made about committee reports. You're just bound taking those same concepts and now applying them to individual statements, but notice the volume goes up. These critiques have more bite. That means, takeaway number one, these statements are almost always treated as less authoritative and less influential by the courts when they're reviewing interpreting statutes. I've had a couple of you come to my office and we've had some great conversations, but one question that pops up is there a hierarchy? And I'm telling you, this one is clear. Reports are almost always treated as more authoritative than individual statements, even if they're by the guy who wrote the statute. Does that make sense? And for the same reasons that's been identified by the great comments we've had so far today. So with that in mind, let's sort of take that central conundrum, those central concerns, and ask a few questions to tease out a little further. I mean, it doesn't just have to be a legislator talking on the floor. I will tell you, I've done this. I know lots of people from our faculty have done this. I know many of the people you'll be working with and for when you graduate have done this. But a lot of legislative language is not written by legislators. It's written by lobbyists. It's written by advocates. It's written by learned jurists and professors. It's written by people filing amicus and letters and advisory briefs. And the language is taken by staffers and integrated wholesale into the statute. If, say, for example, there was provision inserted in a new bill that, let's see, who would like to be an author today? I guess Patrick, you're smiling, that's always dangerous. If Patrick wrote a provision in a bill that was designed to make it more difficult for bankruptcy to be declared for a company that was created and incorporated through an internet site, and the legislators basically were writing a much bigger bill dealing with internet communication issues, and this was a little tiny issue tucked away in another bill, or tucked away in a small provision, you wrote it. You understood it. You might have even testified before the committee about it, but it's clearly your baby. Why isn't his opinion just as probative or relevant as the sponsor of the legislation or the person who wrote the larger bill but didn't really pay much attention to the smaller part of it? And if that's the case, can I call him as a witness? Can I get his testimony, friendly or otherwise, on the legislation? And I'll just ask, would you be wanting to testify in that sort of context?
I guess, sure, but it wouldn't, if I was in a legislator, I don't know that they really care what I have to say.
Well, think more precisely then. You don't. Let's assume that this is the idea, this is not how you want to spend the Friday afternoon. What argument could you pose to resist my subpoena to you to force you to testify about the language that you wrote so we can try and understand it better? Well, I will pose the question to you because I know it sounds fanciful, but this issue does pop up. Oftentimes it's reversed. You have someone who writes the language and then wants to testify about it, and the party who is trying to argue the opposite position opposes the testimony. If you think about it from that perspective, certain things pop up right away. Relevance. If the argument is that legally, this doesn't really matter because you're not a legislator, you're just a learned party, even if you wrote the language, your testimony can't have any probative value. So you move to quash the subpoena. Idea being that, you know, any of you will end up potentially writing legislation. The courts most likely would grant the motion to quash. The courts tend not to give much weight to the statements and intent of individuals, even the ones who draft the statute, if they are not legislative players. Now, we could argue and discuss why that's the case. I will simply note the same exact points you guys brilliantly raised earlier apply once again with even greater force here. Remember, lack of presentation and constitutional dimensions of presentment by camel consideration? You just have someone entirely off the hill writing stuff. Second, subject to manipulation, falsity. A person could write language and then, if he's called to explain what he was thinking, might not necessarily offer a genuine interpretation if it's after the legislation's been passed. Even if you could find a contemporaneous statement, however, the courts are going to be reluctant to incorporate it. Now, this comment I've made has been put in the harshest possible light of a lobbyist, an individual party. But now ask yourself the following question. Would it apply as well to someone who's in the executive branch? Would it apply to someone who is in an administrative agency? They're not legislators. They may draft the language, but they play no constitutionally endorsed role in its review and enactment. But if the White House wrote a bill and sent a statement with the bill to Congress saying, here's what we meant, why is that any different than a lobbyist? A I'm positive. That's a Bucky's t-shirt, isn't it? Okay. I can tell you've been driving the Texas highways a lot. All right. Okay, so any thoughts on that? Who would think that that sort of statement, if you were a clerk on the court and the judge had asked you, should I give this opinion, this discussion statement from the executive branch, any weight at all? And he said, I think it's just like a lobbyist. I'm not going to give this any weight. All I care about is what Congress actually said. All I care about is what's in the statutory language and what the actual proponents, drafters of the legislation, as introduced, the sponsors, care.
You know, at what point in our nation's history did our legislators stop doing their jobs and writing the laws themselves?
That is such a marvelously cynical question, I have to repeat it for the recording. Patrick has asked, when did our legislators stop doing the job of actually legislating and writing legislation themselves? Short answer, that's always been the case. There have always been committees that have taken on the job of drafting that other legislators relied on to review for legislation.
I think that's fair if there are legislators on the committee, but you know, when do we get these Byzantine staffs with thousands of people lobbyists writing bills and waiting for a political party to get in power and say, here, pass this.
I have only a fairly superficial answer for you, which is it tended to accompany the rise of the administrative state. So essentially, as bureaucracies were expanded dramatically as part of the New Deal in late 1930s, early 1940s, you start seeing expansion as well of the congressional bureaucracy to oversee and implement it. Yeah, if you go back before that, yes, there was still staff, still lobbyists, still a role play, but it didn't really become the sort of profession that it did until around that time. And it certainly has grown exponentially since the 1970s. Is that sort of good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Like I said, it's a great cynical question. Any other thoughts, responses at this point? Because we have about 15 minutes before to get through our cases for today. And I want to make sure, let me give a few last other questions as well. And this is one which I have had to fight myself directly. Two questions for you. Number one, what happens when legislators who wrote the legislation decide that the case coming up before the court should have their input, so they submit an amicus brief? An amicus brief that says, hey, judge, we wrote this. Here's what we meant. Put expressio lunis, put justum generis, put impara materia to the side. Musty legalisms. We're telling you black and white, here's what we meant. It seems to sort of cut to the chase, doesn't it? It also is increasingly common. I will tell you that for every major Supreme Court case, the odds are pretty high you're going to find, if not one, at least two amicus briefs filed by legislators who wrote the bill. And the interesting thing is, those amicus briefs will typically disagree. We could try and pull some of the Affordable Health Care Act amicus briefs up so you can sort of see how this works. I don't have an answer for you on this one. In the sense, I'll simply tell you that judges tend to give those amicus briefs slight shrift, especially since most of them are written after the fact and they tend to serve an advocacy's viewpoint. But nonetheless, it poses an interesting theoretical question. If the job of the judge is to interpret the intent of the legislator, and you have the legislator telling you, why can a judge have the power to basically discount that? Second question, and this one is also very common. Bills don't happen all at once. Usually, legislation gets passed, but then the next step is you have to actually appropriate money to get it done. And a lot of times there is backdoor legislation taking place on statutes passed by a Congress where a subsequent meeting of that Congress or even a second Congress actually gets around to allocating the money to implement it. And you'll see what are called funding rifles. Essentially a small tucked away line in a giant appropriations statute that essentially says, and by the way, the Department of State cannot use any of this money to promote any kind of communication with the Republic of Iran. Shoo. Shuts it down completely. Because those are binding. Agencies cannot spend money that Congress in its appropriation bill has directed them not to spend on that particular activity. Congress has also taken to in trying to change the scope of substantive legislation by dictating how the money spent to implement it can be allocated. Which intent counts? Which matters? On one side, the substantive legislation, you have people actually debating the issues and coming to a compromise that is meant to apply long term. Appropriations legislation tends to be more specific on a particular issue, and it also tends to only be short term. Remember, appropriation legislation is typically only good for 2 years. Which one predominates? The appropriations legislation is after the substantive legislation. Typically, the later statute prevails. But if the appropriations legislation evaporates in 2 years, which intent do you look at? I offer this for you to think about. I will tell you, appropriations legislation and funding writers, there are people in DC who do nothing but this work. And it's amazingly lucrative work as well. I will add, though, that usually the courts will look at appropriations funding legislation not as much as an interpretive tool, but they will give it primacy if the legislation is later than the original legislation and dictates how money can be spent. So if an appropriations legislation says something at odds with the primary statute, appropriations legislation typically wins. Does that make sense for folks? All right. So with that in mind, we have two cases today. And what I'd like to do is ask our reading panel to channel the judge's discussion here. So let's start with our first case, which is Montana Wilderness Association versus U.S. Forest Service. U.S. Forest Service. And I'll just work my way left to right, which means, Clarissa, you're up to bat first. I'd like you to channel Chief Judge Norris for us. And tell us, like, what's going on in this case, right?
Okay, well, Burlington Northern, they had a tender, so they basically wanted to build an access road, but they were in the middle of a national forest, so some environmentalists sued to stop them from building the access road, and the Burlington Northern argued that they had a right of access because of the Northern Pacific Northwest, gave them an implied easement, but the court found that the appellants were right in saying that the a subsequent act said that they don't because it doesn't apply to like the whole country. It applied only to Alaska.
All right. So, let's meander a bit because you've captured the case, but as always, it's the details that are juicy. First of all, I'm curious, how many of you, when you read this case, thought, wait, this sounds familiar? Leo's sheep. We're coming back to the same theme, our famous checkerboards. And remember, what was the holding in Leo's sheep? There you go. That's our real property lawyer, I can tell right now. Professor Kumar probably really appreciates having you in her class. Oh, okay. Never mind then. Okay. So, previously the Supreme Court had already said, with the federal government wants an easement on your land and you have that checkerboard next to it, the government's out of luck. There is no implied easement there. And that was, remember, Justice Rehnquist's moving historical opinion. You could hear the clack of the rails in the background. All right, so what you're saying is then they didn't go then to history, they didn't go to common law, they went to a specific statute. And the statute was interpreted to deal with a particular allegation, which was, and I think you captured a little bit, the scope of the application of it?
Yes, that it applied only to Alaska and not to the
country. Okay, so just so everyone can read along on page 841. I'm assuming you're talking about that language.
Yes.
Okay. So section 1323A and B. All right. So let's dig in then. As always, two layers. What this case is about, but also how it goes about it. So what was the statutory interpretive approach used by Chief Justice Norris here to conclude that this statute, I guess I should have asked you who won, did or did not grant easements in Alaska or outside of Alaska, excuse me?
Yeah, there was no easement.
Okay, so it's limited just to Alaska.
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Why?
Well, first they went to interpretation because they said it was a little bit ambiguous because there's no statutory definition for the national forest system. So they started with the title of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said that the language...
Actually, first, before you go further, what's the general rule on titles of statutes for interpretive purposes?
Aren't they usually not that? They don't have much weight.
It's a bad sign when you start with your weakest part. But let's keep going, okay?
And so they basically said the title showed that it was going to talk about the national forest in Alaska, but then they went to the parallel structure of the two sections that were in question.
Mm-hmm.
Material,
you said it perfectly. Very good.
Well, if they're next to each other, it's meant to have the same effect. So they're saying that basically the structure shows that it also only applies to natural land. And then they said that if you read the entire act together, that supports it even further.
Mm-hmm.
And
so stopping there, everything you've said is just from the text of the statute. It's just gone outside provisions A and B. All right? So, I get the feeling, though, you're about to go off in a different direction.
Well, they do, and when they're talking about the entire act, they do talk about like some policy for
mm-hmm.
why they interpret it that way, and that not doing it would be inconvenient under the circumstances. But, I mean, they basically do use kind of the plain language because they're saying, absent a clearly expressed legislative intent, the statutory language should be regarded as
okay. So the legislative history then gets a rather long, detailed, and I hate to say kind of muddled discussion, at least personal opinion. You may have found it perfectly compelling and clear. So generally, in broad strokes, what did they look to in the legislative history to either support or discount the idea that this was limited to Alaska?
Well, they're saying that it was very sparse, and it kind of seemed like the only support they had was that there was nothing to the contrary, and if they interpreted the way that Burlington Northern wanted mm-hmm. to, it would have been a big change because it would basically say that this statute is applying to major changes throughout the whole country. So they're saying that the absence of any language is what made it seem that it only applied to Alaska, and they said there was only, in the Senate Energy Committee report, there was only one senator who said, who basically supported Burlington Northern, but he said something after the session was passed that they found that was not mm-hmm. persuasive, and that was basically a Burlington Northern argument.
But that one senator, what was his relationship to the act?
Well, he was on the committee, and...
If I remember correctly, didn't he draft this provision?
Yes.
Kind of would seem to give him a uniquely authoritative role in interpreting what it's supposed to mean. But anyway, you're absolutely right. They only quote one senator, and the senator's statement came 8 days after passage of the act.
Yes, and they were just saying that that's his personal
right.
understanding of it, but not the whole.
All right, well then, I'll pause. I want to make sure for those of you typing along, we underline one thing here. I wish I had my Benedict Cumberbatch voice here, but the Sherlock Holmes allusion, the dog that didn't bark, that one pops up. You'll see it again and again. You'll see it in cases in all fronts. It's worth noting. If Congress wants to take action of material significance and is alleged to have done so in throwaway language without any discussion of the larger issue at play, the dog didn't bark. The court will tend to find an interpretation that reflects the fact that Congress would presumably talk about a major change. The other way it gets phrased is Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes. If they're going to do something major and important, the idea is that they'll talk about it. And if they don't, maybe there's a different interpretation you should be considering of the language. Now, having said that, let me ask you a non-legal question, Clarissa. Were you persuaded by this analysis? And if so, why?
Well, Well, they definitely lay it out in a way where you say that there's nothing going to the contrary, but when I was reading, like even the title, even when I know it's like they started with the title, but I didn't really see how, like where the part was that it applied only to the last show, so I was just saying.
So you, the text actually spoke to you?
Yeah, well, okay. It says like national, I don't know if I understood that wrong, but it just talked a lot about national, and then they were saying that basically supports that it only applies to Alaska.
Okay, because this is a statute, thousands of words, all of which dealt solely with Alaska, and then this one subclause is written in such a way that it somehow grants access rights throughout the entire nation. And you're saying that doesn't ring right true, that the better reading is that it applies just to Alaska? Or am I saying it wrong, you've got the other position?
Well, I think if you, like the statute they put into the book, like the little excerpt, doesn't make it seem like it applies to Alaska, at least when I read it, but I guess. Yeah,
so you think the plain language says it does apply throughout the country?
Well, I just don't understand why they didn't put like where they put like Alaska, Forest, Land. The two sections don't really talk about only Alaska, they talk about.
All right, so you're saying the language of the section seems clear, even though it's a mystery that it's got tucked into a statute dealing with Alaska with every other perspective.
Yes, I just feel like they probably should have been consistent throughout.
Yeah, but the language nonetheless in your mind speaks clear. So you're, to a certain extent, persuaded by BNSF's opinion here. Which means you think Chief Justice Norris got it wrong. And that's perfectly fine. I don't have a dog in this hunt. I should warn you that the office of this textbook actually argued this case. So they do have a dog in this hunt. It kind of shows a bit. Okay. All right, well, time's about up. So what I'd like to do is pause. I want you to freeze in your mind for next Monday. You're channeling of Chief Justice Norris's spirit. Monika, I will ask you to channel Chief Justice Norris yet again on the second case for today, which happens to be exactly the same parties, exactly the same judge, exactly the same court, exactly the same year, exactly the same statute, with a totally opposite result. And see if you two can harmonize your respective spiritual inclinations without causing schizophrenia. All right? With that in mind, I will do want to sort of flag one last thing, which is there is a very important statutory interpretive principle that's also tucked away in the discussion. And it bears notice before I hand over the podium. Pay attention to the idea that the repeal of statutes by implication is disfavored. This is another one to flag in your outlines. It comes up all the time. It's an important statutory interpretive principle. The idea is that if Congress is going to change a prior law, they're presumably going to do it with clear and express language. It's not going to be done backhanded with an unclear language in another statute. If there's an alternative interpretation of that language that doesn't cause a repeal of the prior statute, the court will prefer the narrower interpretation. And there's some reference to that in the Chief Judge Norris's opinion, right, about the idea that repeal by implication is disfavored. Does that make sense for folks? All right. With that, we'll pause. We'll start with the second case on Monday of next week. And I am now getting ready to turn the podium over to our statutory teams. Now remember, as I announced at the start of class, they have asked that we first take 5 minutes for you to break into separate groups, and each of your leaders can discuss with you the last final version of the statute, which has been passed around to all of you, as well as some suggested changes to the statute, which have been sent to you by email. I've tried to post it to the website as well, but some people have told me they've had trouble getting to it. The idea here is that we're going to have a discussion here on the floor. If there are any other changes, revisions, anything else, get it out now. And then we're going to have a straight up vote. And the vote is strictly by majority. If you guys decide this is too much hassle and you don't want to mess with it, it's been a great exercise anyway. It's been fun watching you guys draft. But if you decide that you do want it, just vote it in place and I will be bound by its provisions moving forward. Also, just as importantly, I will be finding next year's class and they will come looking for you. Screw them over. Okay? All right, so with that, Anything else from the team leaders before I break here? Okay, then if you will join your respective teams and then be back in your seats, realistically probably by straight at 10 o'clock. And we'll pick up the discussion there. Oh, yes? Hold on one sec. By the way, I'm restarting the recording. So